50 kids a year on a rare cancer with a particular drug, there's no money in making that drug, so the pharmaceutical companies typically won't spend the time or effort to make them. Well, we've got a facility now where we can make some of these drugs ourselves that are not marketable to the general population, yet very effective and very useful in treating the kids. Other buildings, you'll see a number 14 here, but you don't see a building. Well, there's now a building there built through in part by the Memphis Grizzlies, which is a pro basketball team, gave money to build a short-stay housing for patients, so when they come visit or come for treatment, they have somewhere right close by to stay. And in fact, this big parking lot here is not there anymore. It's a big hole in the ground where they're building a new research and clinical building. So just to kind of mostly show you this to give you a perspective of the general idea of what goes on at this hospital. So the particular problems that I talk about today are all related to particular protocols. These protocols are closed. The data, now we're analyzing the data. But various protocols that have gone on in the hospital. So we have the clinical aspect going on in that front building and all the various work going on in the other buildings and setting that up. So myelosuppression, so if you're not familiar with the term, it's related to your neutrophils or absolute neutrophil count. And when many of these chemotherapeutic drugs are given, your absolute neutrophil counts, which are normally up in this range, drop off because the drugs not only are killing the various cancers that they're attacking, but they're killing your bone marrow. And so you'll give the treatment around here, your neutrophils will slowly drop off due to the effect of the drug, they'll start to recover, give another treatment, drop off, recover, give another treatment, etc. And this is one particular patient. It's kind of nice to make a few different points. First off, this horizontal line here at about 1500 represents the lower bound of acceptable level. So in other words, assuming everybody in here is healthy and not having any immune compromised diseases or anything like that or taking any chemotherapy, your neutrophils are somewhere up probably above 2000 and somewhere in that range. Now, as soon as you get down below this 1500, especially way down in these below 100 or so, then you start to have problems. That is, you have no white blood cells, so you can't fight infection and things like that, and you could get a severe infection, and that could be very serious. And this particular drug called temozolomide, short TMZ, that they use to treat various types of brain cancers, in particular like glioblastomas, neuroblastomas, things of that nature, is given. They originally proposed, oh, we're going to give this drug every 21 days, where I put my little arrows in here. Well, it turns out, and this is just one example, they give the treatment, you kind of get this little bit of a delay of it kind of slowly dropping off, and by about 21 days, it's just reached its lowest point. Clinicians could by no way treat the patient there because their immune system was, and their neutrophils were so low and so on. But they ended up having to wait until this little red box indicates the next time they were actually treated, about almost 30-some days later, and so on. And in fact, the four treatments that were originally scheduled, should have been given there. The last of those four was actually given out here, and you can see the dates to kind of get a perspective of the time scale of what we're talking about here. So the main point of this is, what was originally planned for the treatment with this drug didn't even come close to what happened in actuality because the myelosuppressive pattern was very different than what they originally expected, and so they had to, of course, alter the method of treatment to handle that. And this is just a different pattern to show that these aren't necessarily always nice, simple, pretty patterns that make perfect sense and very easy to deal with. So this is just a different patient. Everything else is roughly the same. First course is given there. You kind of get this little bit of a delay, then the quick drop off to near zero values, and then the recovery. And notice, as I point out here, the recovery. So if you kind of consider this kid's baseline level is probably somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000, which is a pretty reasonably normal level. But they kind of rebounded much past that, and noticed when the second dose was given, somewhere in this range, even after the second dose was given, they're still going up, their neutrophils are still going up, before they finally start to go down again. They didn't go down near as far on the second dose, and in fact you get this third dose, and clearly didn't see any neutropenia or anything like that. The patients did just fine, and or this patient did just fine. In that case, they never really got their their neutrophils suppressed or anything. And then, of course, another dose was given here. That's where my dad was cut off in this particular case. So this is just an example, partly, of an interesting kind of rebound effect, and then some very different dynamics by the third course than by the first course. And I think I just have one additional... Those are the two examples. Now, there's a variety of ways to model this, and if you talk to the average pharmacist on how to do it, they would, one of the traditional methods used is what I would term, and what many people would term, an empirical model. That is, they kind of look at the shape of the data that they have, what they know, kind of fit some empirical function to it, and go with that. And so what, more specifically what I mean is they have a PK or a pharmacokinetic component, and that would be described here. So they've got a time drug concentration curve. This is just a sketch without the data, but samples are taken from patients, and we know specifically what the drug disposition is, and we can calculate an area under this curve to kind of give us an idea of how much drug's in the patient. And obviously, the bigger the area is under that curve, the more drug that's in the patient. So a very simple calculation there. There's other. So one way to describe the PK or the pharmacokinetic effects is an AUC, area under the curve. There's other methods, such as you look at a threshold, like the time above a particular level. Let's say 10 units, 10 in this case milligrams per liter of the drug. We, for whatever reason, might know that if you're above that, the drug is effective, and if you're below it, it's not effective. And so you might use a threshold and look at the time above a particular level. Most of what I'll show is related to the AUC. So then they take that information and try to relate it to the effect, whatever the effect might be. The effect could be a lot of things. In this particular case, in this example, it'll be the NADAR. That's the time to the percent difference from the baseline level of the neutrophils to the lowest level. So if you look on the previous graph and you take the difference between baseline level, which we'll call the first level, and this lowest level, we get that percent difference is what we mean by the NADAR. And for each patient, you get that. And so, of course, if the AUC is very small, near zero, i.e. there's very little drug in there, you'll see very little effect. And the hypothesis would be the more drug you have in the system, the bigger the effect, and of course we're making the assumption that it plateaus out. And this idea is used a lot, and it's just very simple mathematics to give you these equations, and then you use very simple parameter estimation to get a parameter to describe these equations. And a lot of times this is used in drug development to find an acceptable dose range for a drug, to find out where the effect is acceptable based on toxicity and so on. And this is just another way to measure the effect of the drug. And so this would be a simulated curve of the ANC, the neutrophils change over time. So, you know, you get the drug, they drop off, they recover. And you could look at an area between the curve, either with respect to respect to the baseline level for that individual patient at day zero, or some fixed baseline level, just to kind of give you a different measure of this idea of an effect. And then various authors have worked at trying to make this a bit more general, more complex in a sense, and they've developed more complex mathematical models of this effect type thing. So in this case, they have this effect equation, C is a drug concentration, and you want to relate that to effect. And so, for example, here, as I point out, if this power is just a 1, and this is just a parameter, C sub 50 is just a parameter for the 50% effect. If it's much larger than the drug concentrations, then this is just approximately C, and thus this is just an AUC, and then this model here, the effect model, is just the, what I was just describing in the previous slide, and so on. But then as you vary the difference in this power in here, you can get all the various variations in between and make a more complex model to describe more complicated patterns there. But again, it's an empirical model that really doesn't tell us much what's going on, and there's other problems with it too. In particular, in my data that I'm looking at, just to plot it out, and we'll just maybe look at the left graph first. Each data point is an individual patient. Their particular area under their concentration curve, so this patient right here had somewhere around the 30. Their change in their neutrophils was about 65 to 70%, and so on. But you'll notice over the range of AUCs we have, with the exception of this one patient down here, all the data is stuck up here. And you probably should be looking at this and say, I don't know if I believe your curve fit. You know, I could have fit this, and it could have come out here and come down. You know, I mean, just one point there. In fact, if you look at change in platelets is just another measure of toxicity of the drug. There's no data down here. You know, I could have fit a straight line through that. You know, you're kind of dreaming if you think that I've done a good job in describing this data. So this idea is not very helpful to me, like say. Maybe if I had given, or if I hadn't given, if the clinicians had given a lower dose of treatment, then maybe we could have filled in this lower portion of the curve and we would have really been able to describe it. But that's not the case, and in fact, there's ethical reasons why you wouldn't have given the low dose. It wouldn't have had any effect on the tumor, probably. And other thing you might notice is there's a reasonable amount of variability in the result. So just briefly, for this particular data set that we're looking at, this relationship between the pharmacokinetics and the pharmacodynamics is not that strong. So it's using the ideas described in the beginning, while they're very useful in many problems, aren't that useful in this particular problem. And so the other main point I wanted to make here is that the models such as this are not predictive. I can't make a prediction of what's going to happen in the same patient in the future, say in a future treatment, or even predict in general what might happen based on altering the treatment in some way or another. So what's happened, and various authors have worked on what I would term as mechanistic models. That is, we try to take what we understand as a mechanism of bone marrow production of cells and the mechanism of how the drug would affect it, put all that into some type of a model, and see if that can describe our data more robustly. And so what I'll show you as we go along is the drug that I was just looking at, temozolomide, TMZ, and another drug that we use, topotecan, for short, TPT, look at the various variations of the mechanistic models on neutrophil production. And this is not necessarily a new idea. For roughly the last 25 or so years, various models have been published. Some of the classical stuff by Ribnow and Lebowitz, and then Michael Mackey and Glass and several other colleagues for many years have been publishing models on looking at neutrophil production and modeling neutrophil production, and then some more recent stuff by Lee Siegel's group and myself, and then some of this literature down here is more in the cancer field, but various papers where they're trying to describe using variations of the mechanistic models, and some of which I'll show you in the different slides coming up. And the hope is that by a better understanding of the mechanism of the hematopoiesis, that is the blood cell production in general, we can better understand the possible causes of the myelosuppression. If we can understand these causes of the myelosuppression, then we can help guide a clinician on when and how to best treat so that we cannot have excessive toxicity. So this is just to kind of give you the start, the idea of what the mechanistic model that will derive, kind of a diagram of what's going on in bone marrow and hematopoietic regulation. And this is kind of a a scheme roughly adapted from some work by Michael Mackey. And so, to kind of give you a general idea, everything to the left of this point of my diagram is going on in the bone marrow. The little bit to the right, what you in the circulating blood, which you can actually observe. So it's kind of important to note, we can't really easily observe anything here. Now, it's very easy to get a blood sample from a patient, take it to the lab, get a CBC, which is a complete blood count, done on it, and figure out all the, and get a value for the absolute neutrophil count, the platelets, the red blood cell count, all that kind of stuff. That's very easy, it's not too expensive, and when the picture, the diagrams in the first couple slides, you'll notice it was done fairly often. In fact, some of the later data, I've got almost daily results in most patients on that. So it's a very easy thing, but that means I'm getting an observation very late in the game here. There's a lot that's happened in the in the bone marrow before I can actually observe anything. So just in general, you've got a general stem cell population that's reproducing. Those stem cells will differentiate either into platelets, red blood cells, or what we'll mostly talk about today, the white blood cells. And so they get into these CFUs, colony-forming units. So at this point, they're destined to be white blood cells. The cells are differentiated enough to get in that phase. They're still proliferating. And then they do some maturation, and they're still proliferating. And then they do some maturation while they're not proliferating. And then they get put out into the circulating blood as white blood cells to attack your any diseases that you might have there, and then eventually those cells die off. Now, in a normal human being, it roughly takes about 6 days to get from back here, from the initiation of producing a white blood cell, to actually seeing it in the circulation. So, for those who like to think in terms of mathematics, that's kind of like a delay differential equation, in fact. Excuse me. Some of the work done by Mackey, I'll briefly show it. It relates very simple but elegant delay differential equations to this process. Second important thing is all the stuff to the left where it says proliferating is all the point where a chemotherapeutic drug such as the ones that I'm interested in, the temozolomide and topotecan, can actively kill those cells. Once you get into this phase, the drug is not able to kill it. These cells aren't proliferating. The cell has to be proliferating for these drugs to work. These drugs basically modify the DNA of a cell in various ways so that when it tries to split its DNA, it gets confused and it can't do it and it kills itself. So that's basically the way these drugs work and why they're only effective in these early phases. Excuse me. And then secondly, there's some interesting, from both a mathematical and a biological point of view, some interesting feedback going on here. That this isn't just a straightforward constant production of cells and they die off and everything's happy. Basically, assuming that we're all healthy human beings in here and our neutrophils are at a reasonable level, then there's this GCSF, which is granulocyte colony stimulating factor, this factor that basically regulates your production. So if you have normal levels of production of neutrophils and you have normal levels, then this signal will be a very strong block to prevent too much proliferation at this stage. So let's say you lose some blood, a lot of blood for whatever reason, you get treated with a chemotherapeutic drug that knocks your neutrophils way down, and the level of your circulating white blood cells goes way down. Well, that'll increase this signal to say, hey, we need more white blood cells. And so it'll increase the production of your white blood cells. And there's other various growth factors for the other components of your blood also. And so just briefly to kind of give the historical background of some of the models, one of the classic models was developed by Mackey and Glass a while back now. And it's kind of interesting because it's a very, if you look at it, there's two variations. That's one model and that's another variation, which are just simple delay differential equations, which actually led to some really interesting dynamics if you just look at it from a mathematical standpoint, and it led to some very interesting dynamics if you look at it just from a biological standpoint. And just to kind of make it straight, all they look at is a homogeneous population of mature circulating neutrophils. So essentially that was the last column on the right of the diagram in the previous slide. So they basically don't directly look at what's going on before that. But then they account for that delay from the signal to start production of the neutrophils to end production of neutrophils with a delay differential equation. So this P sub tau is just a delay term of this form. And then they get either this form of the differential equation or this, and you'll notice the main difference is whether is the in this this is the growth the production term of the circulating cells, and there's two slightly different variations of that, and then they have, of course, the linear cell death and equation. And just to show some examples pretty much directly out of their work on this, so in a normal human being with the delay of approximately 6 days, time in days, neutrophil, you get just a nice periodic oscillation from that little delay differential equation with, as you notice, the amplitude centered around 1 and amplitude of about plus or minus 15% or so. And in fact, if you went and had your doctor do a blood cell count on you daily for the next few weeks, you might notice that your neutrophils are kind of odd. I mean, it's not going to be a perfectly nice sinusoidal curve, but it'll most likely oscillate up and down. Is just a different way to look at it. But then they use their model to look at not a cancer treatment or anything like that, but at some various other hematological disorders, where in some of those disorders it is known that there's a delay, the maturation process gets delayed in the production of neutrophils to say something like maybe 20 days. And what happens in that case, you get some much different dynamics in your neutrophil. You kind of get this quasi-periodic and at some values for the delay even chaotic. Same differential equation. Only parameter that got changed was the delay from 6 days to 20 days. Yeah, just that simple, one little simple differential equation, simple delay differential equation. And you get this, really, you know, if you forget the biology at all, if you just like mathematics, you can kind of look at it and say, there's some really cool dynamics going on there. And I can say vice versa. If you don't understand the mathematics at all, but you're a clinician who's treating some of these various hematological diseases, and you see your patients that have these really kind of odd oscillatory patterns in their neutrophil counts, you say, hey, you know, that kind of describes what I'm observing in the clinic. And they were making that point in their paper. And in fact, if you haven't read this paper, it's a very short and very easy to read paper, very nice, just describing a very simple model in, of this. And so they kind of see this interesting pattern here. And again, notice also that the oscillations are much larger oscillations here. And of course, in the normal human being, they had like a small oscillation, it's no big deal. Here, when you get these big dips, of course, could be very detrimental to someone. Just for the sake of time, we'll go to the next slide. So we'd like to be to extend models like that a little bit more and more directly account for what's going on in the bone marrow. So they've essentially accounted for what's going on in the bone marrow with that delay term, basically saying the signal to tell me to grow is delayed by 6 days or 20 days, and that's what's essentially driving all the various oscillatory patterns. We and others would like to explicitly put it in there and also account for some of the negative feedback based on the GCSF, on the growth stimulatory feedback loop that's known to be in there. And I'm just pointing out here, it's pretty much known experimentally that there's an inverse relationship between circulating neutrophils and the levels of GCSF in the system. So it's experimentally known that that's the case, and you get that inverse relationship. It's easy to put some type of an inverse relationship into the equation, so we'll account for that. And also, we, in many cases, GCSF is available as a drug that you can actually give a patient, and it's used to help patients recover from myelosuppression due to chemotherapy. And it's been observed and known that when you administer exogenous GCSF, you get an increased increased peripheral neutrophil counts. In other words, it's observed that, of course, your neutrophil counts go up. It increases the oscillations in them, but what I'm more interested in is it for example, is this last one, it decreases the average maturation time. In other words, it increases the speed in which the cell matures and gets through the maturation stage in the bone marrow, maybe from 6 days to something less than that. And all this type of delay in this feedback, as you might guess, can lead to various oscillations in the neutrophils, and there are a variety of references by Mackey that talk about this, and also observe that some of those oscillatory type patterns that we see in our treatments that we have. And then others have developed models, and you'll notice this model essentially, just from a schematic point of view, looks exactly like the picture that I put up a little earlier describing neutrophil production. And they developed this little model, but they had, in this model, they had this feedback added in. And the big difference between the model that they've described here and what we'll end up showing later is they have a constant stem cell production. And then essentially the drug, when the drug's given, will just block that. In other words, the drug's given, it blocks stem cell production. The drug's gone, stem cell production continues on at a constant rate. And it works fine in their model describing toxic effects of this drug, 5-FU in mice. Though, as I'll show later on, we want to make some modifications of that for the data that we have at hand. And then they actually did some variations of that model, which we'll look at variations that we were looking at the same time, where in this case they do, the little arrow like this would refer to a first-order kinetics, that is, the production of the neutrophils is not a constant rate, but is a function, a first-order function of the of the stem cell population. And then they again have this inverse feedback related to the GCSF. So just some of the classic, or some of the more recent models being done. And then we'll do for the term of all my data, that is some of the data I showed you at the very beginning of the talk. We'll basically taking a slight variation of that similar model, just have a variety of maturation compartments. The main point is the drug is only active back here in the proliferating cells in the bone marrow. And secondly, as we have this GCSF signal, that as your neutrophil counts get very high, that it inhibits this growth rate. So in other words, you have high peripheral neutrophil counts, you have low growth rate, and if you have very low peripheral neutrophil counts, you have high growth rate, all regulated by this GCSF signal. So that's essentially the model that, in fact, we have this as published if you're interested. The references here, I have electronic copies of it, or you can, if you're interested in seeing that model. And so a little bit about the model and why I came up with that particular model as opposed to some variation of it. So for example, what good is the use of this model? One, it helps us understand the effect of the drug, and this is why. For example, there's two options. I could either assume that stem cell production is a constant rate and the drug just blocks the stem cell production, as I'm going to describe on the left. And then when the drug is eliminated from the system, that block goes away, the stem cell production continues at its normal rate. Or it's cytotoxic to the stem cells, that is, the drug actually is killing the stem cells, not just blocking them. Now, actually, I could get a perfectly nice fit, so this is just the first course of the data in one sugar patient as an example. I could have gotten a perfectly nice fit to both of these. Right, because I got my, based on my parameters. If all I did was blindly fit the data and not look at the parameter estimates. The problem would be is this little orange box down here, but the width of it roughly describes the time, and this is time in days along the axis, but roughly the time that the drug is in the system and active. Once you get to the right of the little orange box, the drug's cleared from the system. There's no drug, essentially, in the plasma of these kids. Now, to be able to describe this data well using the model where I just assumed that the drug blocks the stem cells, I would have had to pretend like the drug was active roughly 6 times longer than we know it was in the system. I could get perfectly good fit, but my parameters are perfectly ridiculous for this problem. We know good and well that the drug's not there. But if we make the other assumption, the other model assumption, that it's cytotoxic to it, then with the drug only active for as long as we know it's active, we can describe that data acceptably well over the time. So again, I forgot to say, on all these graphs, I'm plotting neutrophils, count A and C, absolute neutrophil count, on the y-axis and time on the x-axis. And the neutrophil count in all these plots is normalized, so you'll notice it all starts at 1. It's like all normalized to 1, just for ease of comparing various plots. So secondly, yes? Yeah, so basically it would be a zero order production rate of the stem cells for the left. So just a constant rate. So essentially in the model, the drug just makes that constant zero when the drug's there. When the drug's not there, it goes back to its whatever level it's at. Okay. Over here, because it's a first order rate, the stem cell production is a first order rate, it's based on, of course, the concentration of stem cells in the system, right? So if the drug, of course, reduces it, which it does, reduce the stem cell population, then when the drug's removed, because of the first order nature of it, you're going to have lower production until it gets built back up. So that's how it's explicitly modeled. And so the second thing that these models are useful in are describing. For example, you might argue, well, is it necessary to put this interesting feedback mechanism? And we know it's there, but is it really necessary? There's a lot of factors that we could probably put in this model that aren't necessary to just make it more complicated. Is this one necessary? So on the left column, I'm looking at the model without the feedback. Essentially, I take the same model, I just take out the term that's the negative feedback, simple enough. And you say at first, you say, I just fit to the first dose. And you say, well, you don't need that feedback. Look, you describe the data perfectly well. And in fact, with the feedback, I describe it perfectly well also, though with the feedback, you'll notice I kind of get this little overshoot, kind of an oscillation, partly due to the feedback, just the math, essentially kind of related to the mathematics. But then you say, okay, I've got an acceptable fit here and here. Can I use this model to predict what's going to happen in the second course? Well, okay, I add the second course. I'm not trying to fit all this data here. I'm basically taking the parameters I got from the estimate for the first course and saying, okay, now predict out the next course. Put the dose in there and predict out. Well, of course, I'm not quite describing this the recovery well. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. The second yellow box is somewhere just before 40 days on where the second treatment is. And, of course, the first one is at time zero. And so you'll notice I'm not really getting the recovery described well, as opposed to if I include the feedback, I'm describing the recovery pretty well. And so it's indicating how the GCSF feedback mechanism really is necessary to understand the recovery. Now, for this particular drug, these patients were not given exogenous GCSF. This is all, excuse me, an endogenous. Oh, I think I'll be. I hope I'll be. No, I should be all right. This is all just a natural process going on in the body. In the next drug, in the last few examples, we also have examples where GCSF was given to the patients to help them recover. And so finally, all this has been a drug, temozolomide, and I've actually been showing results for one particular patient. I'll put a couple other examples up. This is just one nice fit. So this is over, keep in mind, this is over 120 days of data here.
Is this actual data with a human?
Yeah, this is one particular kid that was on temozolomide treatment. a couple of years ago. And so you say, first you say, oh, it looks like a really nice fit there. You fit the data well. But keep in mind, that fit, I only estimated the parameters based on this first course here. Okay, the way I did this is I did not put all this data in there. I said, estimate the parameters based on this first course. Now, based on that, can you predict what's going to happen on course 2 and 3? And as you can see, for this example, I'm not going to claim I can do this for everybody, but in this example, I did a pretty darn good job. I mean, this data is not, you know, it's not perfectly clean data. There's variability in it. But you can see it's very well picking out the oscillations in the treatment just based on what we knew about the first course treatment. Again, this is over 120 days. These kids vary a lot over time. You can't expect anything to stay constant over time, and in fact, I'll be a good presenter and not show you only the good data. This would be an example. Now, keep in mind here, this is over 300 days, almost just a little under a year of time of data. Now, it'd be kind of absurd to think that if I could generate data from just the first course that over, say, a 20 or 30-day period, that I could predict what's going to happen 300 days out. And in this example, clearly I can't. But what I can do is, so this would be a case where you kind of would dynamically develop the model in this particular individual as time goes on. So, of course, I get the parameters to describe the first set of data, and you'll notice that the data is a little rough here, but it describes the second course reasonably well. Right? So that was just a fit to the first course, describe the second course. And then what I do is, like, well, now I have more data. I might as well add that new data to the problem, now fit the first two courses. Parameters get changed a little bit because the patient's changing over time, and try to predict future courses from that. Well, from that, I get the third course pretty well. The fourth course, okay, I'm kind of overshooting the recovery, and then it starts to fall apart by the fifth course or so. So, again, we can do a reasonable job. Obviously, what I'd want to do in the future is keep adding more courses in my dynamics of picking up. Yeah. Yes, so basically something like that, a maximum likelihood estimation problem. And so, it is the maximum likelihood to be, I shouldn't say it's like it, it is the maximum likelihood estimation. And so, what in the future, what we would, you know, prefer to do is, as each course is given to the patient, you predict that course, then you take all the data you have up to that point, regenerate results and predict what's going on, what you think could happen into the future. I mean, how accurate is each point?
Yeah, I mean, two different things. How good is each individual measurement of what it's trying to measure?
Yeah.
And also, what is the chance, for example, in your 1, 2, 3, 4, your 5th peak there, you think of the prediction was of a relatively high peak. The data doesn't have any high peak at all now that it just missed it, because the measurements were taken at a time when they could have missed the maximum, or is that?
It could be that these are coming from a CBC. So, you know, anytime you hear all these, you know, medical shows on TV, get the CBC. This is a pretty common assay that they run to get these counts. And essentially, there's a person looking under a microscope counting different cell types and so on from a sample. I would suggest that the data is probably, there's not a lot of error in it. Typically, most assays like that, the general rule of thumb is there's 10% or less error in a measurement. In this case, I would probably suspect it's a good bit less than 10%. So when you see a data point here, unless there's a data entry error or something, it's probably pretty accurate. Now, you're right that maybe it's just simply that they just didn't draw a sample in here. My curve fits it beautifully. I just don't have that sample. I don't know that. I'm guessing that might not be the case here, but I don't know for sure. And that's just one other example, but just for the sake of time, we'll like to move on to the second drug and then draw some conclusions. Yeah. Yeah. Why they the drug's not there anymore, so they're eventually recovering. Yeah, the delay in time is simply because, remember, the drug, and use this diagram as an example, the drug's only killing the stem cells, the actively proliferating cells. So it's killing those, but you're not actually seeing the result in the neutrophils till several days later, when that hit to the early proliferating bone marrow stage shifts down and then supposed to get released into the circulating blood, but of course there's not much there to get released. That's why you see this long delay from when the drug's given. And if you remember from those graphs, and you'll see it again in some of these in the next few graphs, the drug's given over the initial period of several days, and your neutrophils are still reasonably high up. And you don't really see the decline until several days later. And that's simply due to the dynamics, the mechanism of what's going on. The kill's happening down here, the observation's happening over here. And there's a delay in time from getting from this stage in the bone marrow to this stage in the circulating cell. Somewhat, though, the schedules really aren't designed based on that. In fact, I put a few little simulations to show what happens with different schedules and so on. But schedules are more for the convenience of the patients and the clinicians than for optimizing optimizing, i.e., reducing toxicity and so on. So this is a model published looking at the drug temozolomide, very similar. We're being a bit more sophisticated. I'm explicitly putting in the pharmacokinetics. That's what's going on with the drug. In the previous model, it was basically the drug was there. I didn't really have any direct model of it. It was the drug was there. It actively killed the cells. The drug went away. It stopped killing the cells. So kind of more of a very easy, discrete yes or no model of the drug effect. But we wanted to get a little bit more sophisticated with this one and put in explicitly the dynamics. So this is just kind of a compartmental description of plasma level, the drug, and then you have this, what they call tissue level, because it's more just for data fitting than anything else. And then that drug diffuses into the bone marrow, which affects the stem cells. In this model, again, they have this constant order production of stem cells where the drug just blocks that, drug's removed. That KN still just the same KN. It doesn't get affected. The zero order term. We modify that slightly to account for several things. First off, we want the first order KN, and again, I'll show some more examples of why that's necessary, not just what we want. Again, this is describing the disposition of the drug in the plasma. And then these patients are given the drugs commercially known as filgrastim, which is essentially just G-CSF, that's given to the patients after the drug's given to aid in the recovery. And so there's some nice things we can do at the model. For example, can we show that the filgrastim, the G-CSF, is actually aiding, helping out these kids recover sooner than they would if you didn't give them the G-CSF? And what it does is it increases the GCSF, as I mentioned earlier, is it increases this production rate, and it also speeds up the time that it takes. So it increases these KBPs, which, just for the sake of uniqueness of parameter estimation, we just make them all the same. It increases those rates throughout so that you get a faster transition through the bone marrow compartment to circulating neutrophils. And I guess it wouldn't be a complete talk on mathematics unless I showed some equations. So this time I'll actually put up the differential equations related to the diagram there. The first set of equations is just related to the pharmacokinetics. So this first equation, x sub c, is just the amount of the drug in circulation in plasma. And it's just simple first order linear kinetics. The term that's most interesting is this one, which is the proliferating neutrophil counts. These are just all those transition compartments, and those are the circulating counts. So we're actually, all our observations are going on down here, And here we have, of course, this term in the big brackets is describing this cell kill due to the drug. This term right here, of course, would be the amount of drug divided by its volume, so that's the drug concentration. IC50 is kind of an important parameter. It's a drug a parameter that's the common terminology describing a 50% effect. So in other words, when the drug concentration is the IC50, then this whole bracketed term is a 1/2. In other words, it's cutting your production rate of stem cells in half. So that term is IC50, and that's kind of important because that will help us understand whether our model is giving us physiological results, because we know we have a good idea of what the IC50 for this particular drug is. They've looked at cell lines, and you treat cell lines in a petri dish with the drug, there's various concentrations, and it's very easy to estimate that. And then this is just a inverse function. I should be more specific. It's an inverse function of the circulating neutrophils to describe the GCSF effect. And you essentially stick this on the computer. It's not too hard to solve numerically, and then do the maximum likelihood estimation to get the parameters. And so this is kind of, in the last example, I was showing you individual patients and the fits to that. In this case, we have two courses of treatment given, and this is essentially a combination of 27 patients down here. I'll be a bit more specific in a second. But first off, this is time drug concentration. So this drug was given daily times 5. We never work on weekends, by the way. And then daily times 5, and then 22 days later, we give the same course again. Okay, so down here, each of the little pink boxes is a median neutrophil level at that particular time. So the median result for the patient at time 0 is, of course, 1, and then, of course, you get down to the median level is around 0. This little brown kind of crude curve is a 10% and 90th percentile, so it kind of gives you an idea of the spread of the data over my 27 patients. So, you know, they all were pretty much between about day 7 to about day 18 or 19 were pretty much myelosuppressed, pretty much as a whole. And then, but their recovery varied. You know, some people shot way up, you know, as much as 4 or 4.5, 5 times baseline level, and others not as much. And so that's what all that is. The blue curve and the green curve, which overlie each other at the beginning, the blue curve describes my model fit to it. This little horizontal red line shows where the GCSF was given. So if you'll notice, it basically started at the end of therapy. Okay, and then the green curve describes the model where I zero off the terms describing the effect of the exogenous GCSF. So in other words, my simulation of what would have happened if we didn't give them the growth factor to help the recovery of the neutrophil. So you'll see they probably wouldn't have gotten the second dose here if they didn't get the GCSF, because they're nowhere close to recovering. And if you simply just look at this horizontal distance, it's roughly about a week. So I can conclude on average that by giving this assistance to the GCSF, that we improve recovery. Down here, there's a lot of opportunity for infection and so on in the patient. So having a week less of being susceptible to infection is kind of important. So secondly, I want to know, do I believe that the model I've developed is physiologically reasonable? Right? I can come up with a lot of models that will fit that data perfectly well. In fact, I have come up with other models that fit that data perfectly well. You get just a nice, pretty curve that goes through it, just like I showed you in the last slide. But the model doesn't meet the test of being physiologically reasonable. What do I mean by that? So, for example, that parameter I called IC50. Well, we know roughly what it is in various literature done in human colony-forming units. The particular cell line, bone marrow cell line, they showed that for this drug, topotecan, is about 1.2 nanograms per milliliter was that. So in other words, if you put 1.2 nanograms per milliliter of drug in the petri dish, you would kill off about half the cells. And if you use our model, but you use that I've developed, but you use a constant production rate, is i.e. assuming that the drug blocks and it's not killing the stem cells, and you get an IC50 of about order of 10 to the minus third. Orders of magnitude different than what we generally know. Of course, I don't have error bars or anything on this value. It's kind of a, but even with them, unless there's huge error bars, this number is much too low. And that's kind of the range of values I get. On the other hand, if I use the model I've actually described in the previous slide, I get a median IC50 of around a half, which, of course, you'll say, well, that's at the 1.2, but at least it's in the same order of magnitude. So I'd argue, based on arguments such as that, that the model is reasonable for a physiological sense, using that as my criteria. Some other points to make on this. You'll notice I can calculate the transition time. That is the time it takes an average cell to make it through from production in the bone marrow to release into the circulating cell. It's simply that BKBP was the transition rate parameter. And there are four compartments. So if you just take four over that parameter, it will be an average time to get through there. So if you do that in medium parameters, it's about 2.5 days with a range from 1.4 to 5.4. You remember before I said that in a normal human being, it's about five to six days as the time. You say, well, wait a second, that's more than half of the time. But you got to remember, these aren't normal patients. These are patients that are getting hit by these drugs. Their neutrophils are going way down, which means their endogenous G-CSF is causing that feedback to in the production, which would then speed up the time through the bone marrow production, which logically would then give you a shorter transition time there. So it's not unreasonable for the transition time to be smaller in these patients. As I already pointed out, that by giving the G-CSF, we decrease the recovery time by about a week. And also, through the parameter estimation, we show that the model shows that the growth rate of the stem cells are increased by the effects of G-CSF by almost 60%, and the transition through the compartments is increased by almost 50% with the introduction of exogenous, that is the treatment of the G-CSF. So it all kind of fits the way we would expect to do it. So coming back to some of the original ideas of, I care about a mechanistic model for some reasons that I've explained before. The model can kind of help me understand what's going on. And secondly, it can be predictive. So let's try to be a little bit predictive. Now, everything I'm showing you from now on out, I don't have any data up here because I don't have any data. I'm taking the data and the results that I've showed you up to this point and saying, okay, let's be predictive. What would happen if, in this case, if we change the dose to the green curve, which I've labeled 2 milligrams per meter squared, is the dose that we were giving in the previous shown data, the actual dose. We cut that in half and gave only 1 milligram per meter squared, you get we predict you get this blue curve. If you increase the dose by a milligram per meter squared to 3 milligrams per meter squared, you get the red curve. And to kind of give you an idea of how would that affect the toxicity of this drug, and you can just basically, if you just roughly look at the different horizontal difference between here to here to here, it's roughly each milligram per meter squared I've increased roughly would increase the delay of recovery by roughly 3 days. Now, again, this is based on the medium parameters. That doesn't mean the patient comes in. I'd have to do this individually for each patient. To say patient A, it might increase it by 5 days. Patient B, it might only be 2 days, and so on. But it gives us an idea of the general overall effect. Another question might be, this kind of goes under the sequencing of drugs, it might be said that, well, would it be easier to give, I want to give, if you figure that out, I was giving 2 milligrams per meter squared daily times 5 over 10 times, so a total of 20 milligrams per meter squared was the dose I was giving. Let's do it two different ways. The way I was doing it, 2 milligrams per day daily times 10, or let's do 4 milligrams per day daily times 5. So in other words, leave out the second set of 5 doses. How would that affect them? You're getting the same amount of drug. Well, then you would get the blue curve would be the basically the more intense dosing earlier. And you'll see, by that, you get a quicker recovery by, what I say, approximately 5 days quicker by giving the drug earlier. But you got to keep in mind, all we're looking at here is toxicity. I haven't mentioned anything, I'm not going to mention anything, on the effect on the tumor. So you might want to weigh the fact of, yeah, we recovered 5 days earlier, but keep in mind that that means the tumor's having a little better luck here also. They're probably not getting hit as hard because the bone marrow's not getting hit as hard. So you kind of have to weigh those two factors in there in the end, but the stimulation kind of gives you an idea of what would happen by a simple varying of the schedule. And the last two graphs just look at, the previous two, I looked at varying the schedule of the drug. Here I'm looking at varying the dose and schedule of the GCSF, this modulator that helps us recover. And of course, the blue curve would be not giving any GCSF, the one labeled one time, meaning the dose that we actually gave them, the 5 micrograms per kilogram per day, was what we already had, this kind of brown curve. If we increase the amount of GCSF that we gave by 50%, you get this red curve. It would decrease, that is, the duration of your myelosuppression a little bit by roughly roughly a day. You know, nothing to sneeze at, but nothing dramatic either. If we cut it in half, it would increase by roughly, what I have somewhere down here, roughly 3 days, the time to recovery. So it might indicate that we want to give where it is, maybe a little bit more, though, by increasing the amount we give doesn't necessarily give us a huge increase in effect. So this drug, like many drugs, has its side effects. We might want to not give it at too high levels anyway and leave it where it is. And finally, I can also adjust the schedule of when I give it. And so get myself oriented. The red curve is the schedule that I have been giving it. So in other words, this kind of big black bar is the end of the Topotecan course, so when the drug stops. So what we do is drug stops, you start giving GCSF for about 8 to 10 days out. And that's the curve that we've been looking at, the red curve. One other option is, maybe we need to start it earlier, start it even before the treatment ended. Well, if you do that, you get this blue dotted curve here, and it doesn't look like it changed it much. Another option is, let's just don't give it over a shorter period of time, but wait till the end of the dose. Then you would not quite have as much of a recovery. So to kind of give you an idea of, as you adjust the schedule and the duration of when you give it, kind of give you an idea how that could affect recovery from the suppression. And so just to draw a few conclusions and end up with that I would like to claim, at least in the situations I'm looking at, I'm not saying that I would never look at or use empirical models like I was describing at the beginning to help me understand these dynamic effects of toxicity or other effects, but in examples such as I'm showing here, these mechanistic models are definitely more appropriate and more useful. Overall, all the drugs that we're considering, it's more physiologically reasonable to use the first order stem cell production. That is, it would implicitly imply that the drug is being cytotoxic to these stem cells, not just putting a block on it. I should point out, there are drugs that can be given that just block the production. They're not cytotoxic, they're just a block. They hold the cells where they can't proliferate, they can't go past the particular phase in the cell cycle, and then you remove the drug, and the cells just move right on through, like picking up a dam or something and letting all the cells move on through. But that's not the case with the two drugs I've considered here. We can use these models to effectively describe the endogenous GCSF, that is, the feedback mechanism naturally in the body, and I'm able to both explicitly shown I can make predictions based on the data that we have. And then the last few slides, I don't have data to show that my predictions are correct yet. Those are predictions I can make and that will be helpful in possibly designing other treatment regimens in the future. So anyway, that's what I have. I'll take any other questions you might have. Yes. Yeah.